Good evening, everybody. Hi, Mira, again.
Hello.
Such a pleasure to have you here.
It really is such a pleasure.
And it's good to see you all here tonight. My name is Pascal Menor. I'm a professor of contemporary Arab studies. And I have the very great pleasure and honor to introduce you as briefly as I can, because we're here to listen to you and nobody is here to listen to myself. So, you're a professor at NYU Abu Dhabi, currently based in New York City. Mm-hmm. We met when you were in Cairo. You were a professor of anthropology at the American University of Cairo. You're known for a first book,
yeah,
and very soon for a second book.
The
first book is called Landscape of War, Ecologies of Resistance and Survival in South Lebanon. And I guess we will hear some of mm-hmm. these arguments tonight. And you're writing a book about Aramco that I'm very, very excited about. We have read some arguments here and there,
yes,
that you wrote for in various forms. The book is about the heart of empire in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Is it still tentatively called the Heart of Black Gold?
Yeah. Yeah,
such a great title. And it's based on an archive coming down from your grandfather, who,
yes,
was one of the first Arabian employees at Aramco.
Aramco, yes.
Tonight's talk is called After the End of the World. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Pascal. Thank you.
And please join me in welcoming Munir Al-Khayyat.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's really such a pleasure and an honor to be here. And I only actually realized yesterday when I was looking at the date of the auspicious date of this talk. It's the 77th year of the Nakba, the catastrophe, the dispossession and the occupation of Palestine, which is ongoing. The Nakba is not an event, as was famously pointed out by Patrick Wolf, of course. It's a structure. And I extend this insight in my work to describe war as hardly an event, but rather a structure, or better yet, an environment, right, in which defined life is waged. So the talk today will be delivered in the spirit of keeping Palestine centered in our hearts and in our politics. So this paper was written during the Israeli war in Lebanon and Gaza that began in Lebanon on October 8th, 2023, and then intensified in Lebanon on September 23rd, 2024, so almost a year later. The paper was completed during the shaky ceasefire in Lebanon between November 27th, 2024, and January 27th, 2025. This was 60 days where a ceasefire was declared. A ceasefire was declared at the end of which the Israeli army was supposed to withdraw from its occupation of South Lebanon. So the last parts of this paper, so this paper was written in this context, and the last parts were added after the second deadline of the ceasefire that was extended until February 18th, and then my first visit to the occupied Lebanese borderland shortly thereafter. During the writing, everything was unclear. The Israelis were constantly breaching the so-called ceasefire and continuing to occupy South Lebanon beyond the first deadline of the ceasefire and the second. The Israeli occupiers were systematically destroying agricultural and residential landscapes, as well as extensive road networks in the Lebanese frontline villages, which are home to all kinds of resistant life and deep layers of histories. So I try my best in what follows to hold my prose steady and to make some kind of sense in this moment of ongoing destruction at the end of the world. This is the map of the borderland. These are the 5 points of occupation where the Israelis remain in South Lebanon. So South Lebanon is once again and still under occupation. And the village that I speak of is next to Jabal Lablat. It's called Ramia. So the ethnographic passage that opens this talk mirrors the passage that opens my book that I researched in the 2 years after the last end of the world in South Lebanon, the July 2006 war, or as we call it, Harb Tammuz. The book, A Landscape of War, Ecologies of Resistance and Survival in South Lebanon, was published in 2022, so already 2+ years ago. But the book remains all too painfully relevant today. The village that centers my book, and that remained unnamed in the book, was, along with 37 other frontline villages, completely destroyed by the Israeli occupiers. The occupation and the methodical destruction of Lebanese villages at the hands of Israeli occupiers took place after the ceasefire, that was not a ceasefire, came into effect on November 27, 2024. The village remains occupied today after the Israeli withdrawal, that was not a withdrawal, was implemented on February 18th, like I just mentioned. And the village is called Ramia, and Israeli soldiers remain in this military outpost in Jabal Ablat, which is across the Merj, the fertile plain of Ramia. Jabal Ablat is one of the 5 military points that that Israel continues to occupy today within the Lebanese borderland. So, where do I begin? In the beginning. Before the noon prayer and after the war, we're sitting outside in the cold December sunlight in plastic chairs in a circle drinking hot sweet tea. 2 weeks into a 60-day ceasefire, we gather in my family's garden on a hill south of Beirut, me and the family from the village who've been staying with us since the escalation of the war, specifically since the night of the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Dahiya on September 27, 2024. The Hajj Im Sahel, her daughters, her son, and his wife, their children and grandchildren, slept that night of terror on the streets along with thousands of others, and then came by my urging to stay with us the next day. We sit together in a momentary lull this morning. Only the Hajj Busahel is missing. The Hajji and the girls recall him fondly. Stalwart in the southern village he loved, in the home that he built, the trees that he planted, the animals he cared for, resisting until the end. The Hajj, his village, his home, his beasts and trees are all memories now. They materialize perhaps as a sharp pain in the heart, an intake of breath, or the sting of salty tears. The Hajj died in the spring of 2021 at the age of 92. He took with him, like all those who die, the many stories that he lived, the wisdom he gathered. More than anything, Hajj Busahel took with him his idiosyncratic and level-headed view of and rooted response to endless seasons of war. The Hajj is buried in the village. But the village. The garden we're in, although under the same sun and sky, is far from the village. The village we know and we love so well, sitting pretty on a hill in Jabal Amil, which is also Galilee, hugging the border with occupied Palestine, ceaselessly weathering seasons of devastation, invasion, occupation, and resistantly remaining the home of the Hajj, their children and grandchildren, is no more. The Hajji silently bows her head and covers her eyes with a bent and a wrinkled hand. When she looks up again, her eyes shimmer with tears. She struggles to her feet, leaning on her cane. Her daughters watch as she limps away in a feeble attempt to hide her sorrow. "Our mother can't stop crying," they say.
Hello.
On the morning of October 20th, 2024, Israeli soldiers detonated explosives they had wired throughout the village, forcibly and gradually emptied of life since October of 2023, blowing it up completely. Videos by the young Israeli soldiers of their audacious act of destruction circulated on social media. The videos showed the olive-green-clad soldiers counting down in Hebrew, then shrieking with laughter and hoots of machismo in the wake of the explosion that pulverized their village. The village, like many others in this ancient land, has been continuously inhabited since the Neolithic, molded by the constant presence of humans and their companion species, and so many empires. This is one of the planet's oldest anthropogenic landscapes, alive with all kinds of beings, laced with lively spirits, and studded with ruins. An image of the village disappearing into a pink pillow of smoke under a glowing early morning moon was shared on the village's WhatsApp group. Members of the group responded with crying, angry, and broken heart emojis, expressions of disbelief praising the heavens. I juxtaposed the haunting image of the village's destruction with a photo that I took during fieldwork in 2008, when the village had defiantly reemerged from the last punishing war of July 2006, and had just been rebuilt, shiny anew. Along with a few words, I posted the heartbreaking collage on social media. The post was widely shared. At some point, the New York Times actually took my photo off of X or Twitter and then repurposed it for an article about the destruction of the villages. Helplessly trying to fathom the world-ending loss of the place that centers my ethnography of life and war in South Lebanon, I sent a voice note to my friend Rida, asking how she feels about the erasure of her village, including the home that she had just completed building and in which she had not yet lived, and now she never will. She responded, "I don't know. It's as if we've become numb. It did feel like we couldn't feel. How does one feel at the end of the world? And how does one write at the end of the world again? Far from the complacent perch of Northern theory, confident of its very grounds, and of a sun that'll rise tomorrow, this talk is written from another world, the time and the place of devastation, after the end of the world. Drawing on my re-theorizing of war as a place of life, not merely of death and destruction, this talk stays insistently within the blasted existential groundlessness of the moment and its unknowable temporal arc. This act of genocidal, of ecocidal terror, this ending and erasing of worlds, is monstrous, and yet it's nothing new under the sun. It has happened time and again, perpetrated across the planet in recent centuries, largely by settler colonizers. Here, it's been happening across South Lebanon and Palestine, perpetrated by the settler colonial state of Israel since 1948. Right now, alongside the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the ongoing erasure of the rest of historical Palestine, one of the latest chapters of Israel's expansionist settler colonial project is being realized in South Lebanon. Haibib, Blida, Meis al-Jabal, Kfar Kila, Khiam, Ait al-Sha'ab, Ait Arun, Yarun, Hanin, Marwahin, Ghaira, and Ramia, the village I speak of here, are but a few of the 37 Lebanese villages wiped off the face of this earth in November and December of, in October and November of 2024 by the Israeli invaders and occupiers. Ancient villages with layers upon layers of material and immaterial pasts and presents, such as Roman and Crusader ruins, olive groves, mosques and churches, multifamily homes, hearths, stables, kitchen gardens, graves of loved ones and ancestors, shrines of the prophet, of prophets, such as the more notable one of the 2,000-year-old shrine of Prophet Benjamin, son of Jacob, in Mhaibib, which was actually pulverized by the Israeli invaders and occupiers. Mhaibib was one of the first villages to be exploded, and the shrine went with it. Friendly and naughty spirits, fertile fields and terraces, plants and animals, both domesticated and wild. Resistant life is in the land. Rooted deeply. And this is why the Israeli war machine, set on destroying resistance, destroys life. It destroys everything. This is a drone footage of the village done by some of the Shebeb from the village that documents the extensiveness of the destruction of Ramia. Here are some images from the vibrant life in the villages prior to their annihilation. Take note of this wedding, of the wedding scene. You will see it's something related to it later in the slideshow. These border villages are now once again occupied by the same settler colonial entity occupying adjacent Palestine, the same that has since 1948 erased Palestinian and Lebanese villages from maps and from history, the same that has annihilated indigenous life across generations and continues to do so, now with a chilling, methodical intensity, audacious, shameless, and unbound. Lebanon and Palestine, historically entwined landscapes that were in 1917 rudely riven by a line drawn by Sykes and Picot, British and French colonizers, are one continuous landscape of ongoing Israeli settler colonial violence that is happening right now under our watch. What we need to comprehend and what we need to center in our outrage and analysis is the intentionally ecological, environmental nature of this military violence that is realized by American-made bombs. The settler, the colonial imperial entity eradicates indigenous life in all of its heterogeneous forms in order to dominate, control, replace, rule. Of course, this ecocidal and genocidal violence is not violence that is inhabited passively by its human and non-human receivers. This world-ending violence is violence that is necessarily, continuously, actively resisted, militarily and otherwise, by all of its targets. I intentionally refrain here from using the word victim in order to really highlight the agency of those who live and face up to and stand up to these ongoing and enduring structures of annihilation. I've called these collectives waging life in the face of intentional annihilation resistant ecologies. What we're living now and trying to make sense of through mortal faculties struggling at the limits of rational and emotional comprehension is another end of the world. This is not a metaphor, nor is it a clever theory crafted to convey an intellectual thrill or a slight existential zing to the curious reader. Unlike many authors that are confronting what is being called the Anthropocene, I'm writing this, or I'm trying to, from the thick of a deliberately destroyed world, my world and the world of those that are closest to me, that has just been destroyed. Again, this makes it hard to write, to speak, because there is no stable point from which to observe, to capture, to recount or clarify as the bombs rain down, lives are violently ended, and fires rage. It's hard to maintain a scholarly voice, a commitment to abstraction and analysis, to calmly parse details at a distance from a world that is never at a distance from me. So note this house as well, because you're going to see it again at the end of the presentation. This is by no means the first time, but it is the most intentional, brazen, unfettered, and ongoing Israeli effort to annihilate everything. This round, the homegrown Lebanese military resistance, Hezbollah, which emerged in the wake of the bloody 1982 Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon, honing its asymmetrical fighting skills over decades of guerrilla warfare in South Lebanon, and in May 2000, successfully ending the 22-year Israeli occupation of the Lebanese borderland. So they occupied South Lebanon for 22 years, and in 2000 they unilaterally withdrew because the resistance had prevailed. So this is a point in which to also point out that occupations do end. So in May 2000, the Hezbollah, which was the resistance that grew up out of the 82 invasion, they successfully ended the 22-year Israeli occupation of the Lebanese borderland. But this war, it has suffered a major blow. Although the resistance remained tenacious on the ground in South Lebanon, repelling the Israeli army's advances until the ceasefire came into effect, Israel managed through relentless bombing campaigns in residential areas with bunker blaster bombs and incessant drone attacks striking everywhere to systematically assassinate all of the military resistance's top leadership, including the much-loved Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who led Hezbollah for 32 years. It is this shattered and shattering moment that we're in. With the resistance in abeyance, will a resistance rise again? Of course. As long as there is occupation, there will be resistance in Lebanon as in Palestine, as anywhere. But in the meanwhile, and that is now, we try to absorb this reality and to find the ground beneath us, to recollect ourselves, and to carry on living. So much is unclear, and yet one fact is as clear as day. Israel has invaded Lebanon again. and continues to occupy and destroy the entire borderland again. The latest Israeli invasion of Lebanon and its continued occupation is a political problem. It's a social problem, a moral problem, and considering the overwhelming and complete nature of the destruction being carried out, it's an environmental problem. It's a planetary problem, just like Palestine. Israel's unhinged war on Lebanon and Palestine is certainly not just a local affair involving the killing and the dispossessing of people who do not qualify as humans in the eyes of the civilized world. Civilized. If we shift the grounds of our writing and thinking, analysis, and politics to the actual grounds of life in these worlds of war, what I call, in my work, War from the South, we get a clearer, an environmental and ecological picture of the lived realities that fellow humans must actively navigate to stay alive in those worlds. Upon further reflection, we may realize that those wretched beings living through the end of the world again might be able to teach us a thing or two about resistance and survival in the end, in our end. I mean, that's something to also countenance. For more than two decades, I've researched life and war in South Lebanon, and of course I've also lived it for longer because I grew up in Lebanon during its very many wars. But I've researched it or been actively kind of like witnessing wars in Lebanon since the liberation of South Lebanon on May 2000, where I witnessed the collapse of the 22-year Israeli occupation. I was a young journalist at the time. I was there during the July 2006 war and its aftermath. And then I did field work in the now destroyed villages on life in a landscape of seasonal war and destruction. So since I'm a sort of a long-term inhabitant of war, I really wanted to look not at the spectacular sort of dimensions of war that we kind of see when we're at a distance from it, but to look at the way in which life is waged in war. So life has always been my focus. So I did field work in those destroyed villages on life in a landscape of seasonal war and destruction. I have, together with my friends, human and otherwise, in the line of fire, in the eye of seasonal war storms, in frontline villages, illuminated the standing fight to stay alive beyond the end of the world. The latest and ongoing season of war in South Lebanon resumed in the olive season after 17 years of relative calm. So the olive season in our part of the world are in October and November. Those are months that have both have the name Tishrin, so they're called the Tisharin, Tishrin 1 and Tishrin 2. So the war began in October. So it began after 17 years of relative calm in South Lebanon, one day after the Israeli war on Gaza began. In solidarity with Gaza under attack, Hezbollah, which was the military resistance in Lebanon, fired across the dormant front line, which even as all kinds of life resurged along it, had remained in a state of expectant preparedness since the last war raged there in July 2006. Immediately, Israel began to rain down a season of devastation upon the living landscapes of South Lebanon. Beginning on October 8, 2023, Israeli bombs fell daily on Lebanese Galilee, destroying villages and lighting fires in the olives, the laurels, the woodlands, the fields, killing and wounding civilians and their companion species, alongside fighters in the Lebanese resistance. Like in Gaza, the target of this vicious assault is ostensibly military, but in actuality, what is being destroyed are the vital ecologies underwriting life in this borderland. Multi-species alliances, including human, animal, and plant life forms, and even spirits. In South Lebanon, the many prophets that remain in the land are also considered a part of the social world there. So friends who are farmers in frontline villages and depend for subsistence and income on the agricultural seasons of tobacco, olives, and subsistence crops, as well as on livestock such as goats, told me that they were being intentionally targeted in the orchards by the Israeli military across the nearby borderline. One friend from the village said to me during the days of relentless white phosphorus rain in the early phase of the war, they see us tending to our livelihoods and they shoot at us because we're out in our orchards harvesting our olives and living our lives while they cower in shelters. As has been extensively documented, the Israeli army along the border was firing white phosphorus at harvesters in the olives, setting their trees on fire, and then targeting the firefighters when they rushed in to douse the flames. Harvesting under the bombs and not fearing war is a defiant posture, but still, in the first year of the war, more than 100,000 villagers fled the Lebanese borderland to greater safety in the villages and cities outside of the line of fire. But on September 23rd, 2024, the fire caught up with them. On that day, almost 600 people were killed in an Israeli aerial bombing campaign of unprecedented intensity, and 1.5 million were displaced, about a fourth of the entire Lebanese population. In the first year of the war, because of the constant rain of bombs across South Lebanon, there were no profitable seasons of harvest, such as tobacco and olives, nor subsistence farming that crucially eases the cost of living for most villagers. And I need to underline this, that most of the folks who live in those borderland villages are the vulnerable poor, who really rely on the land to get by. So there were no winter crops, no foraging of wild herbs in the spring, no fresh bounty of the seasonal kitchen garden appended to every village home, no hectic and rhythmic summer tobacco harvest. As the war precipitously escalated into a war of annihilation at the end of September 2024, entering its second year, the olive crop went unharvested again. The orchards were incinerated again. According to satellite imagery and field surveys analyzed by whitephosphorus.info, over 4,500 hectares, which is around 11,000 plus acres, of agricultural and forested land in South Lebanon was directly affected by white phosphorus contamination. The numbers are still being compiled, but images and reports of ecological damage in the borderland are horrifying. The ancient olive groves of Al Mashab and Derbi Mas, with 1,000-year-old trees bulldozed and uprooted, the storied pine forest of Yaroun scorched, the woodlands of Rahab Hill denuded, this is Rahab Hill before the ecocide, this is Rahab Hill after the ecocide. The steep gorge of Wadi Zahjer and Sulu'i, where the Litani River, whose waters have long been desired by the Israelis, runs, pummeled and poisoned by all kinds of incendiaries and explosives, and ravaged by earth-moving machines. Of course, the seasons keep turning, so they don't only kill nature, they also destroy infrastructure, like quite meticulously, as you can see in this image. Of course, the seasons keep turning, even as the deadly season of human rot annihilation, battering down, remains steady. In the second year of the genocide in Palestine and of the ecocide in South Lebanon, in the Mediterranean, we're back, wars notwithstanding, in the green season, Mawsim al-Khadar. The meadows and hills of Jabal Am al-Galilee are covered in a bright green carpet with speckles of wildflowers, and the tender herbs like khbeze, tayun, hindbe, shumar, za'atar, irsani, that are foraged by all villagers, are plentiful in the woodlands and maki, and fruit trees are in tender flower. As the rainy season ends and the sun shines hotter, the earth should be plowed and readied for the summer crops, especially tobacco. But given the utter ruin that the Israeli war machine has systematically laid upon the landscape of South Lebanon, it'll be another season of immense loss, even for those who can access their fields and their orchards again. So the planting season is usually in February and March and April, and then the seasons of harvest begin in May, June, July, August, September, October, right? So we're once again in a season of loss. My work as an anthropologist and as a human on a war-ravaged planet explores how do those who are relentlessly besieged and who continue to inhabit such embattled landscapes live in such conditions? This isn't an easy question to ask, because we all know that no one should live like this. For fear of normalizing war as an environment and a living condition, which it is for too many beings on this planet, we tend to postpone or to resist asking this difficult question. But ask it we must. For the harsh fact is that too many beings on this planet live in war, and almost all of those wars are in the global south. And that's also why these wars are hardly visible, or only occasionally visible. Landscapes and life worlds of war, such as South Lebanon and Palestine and Sudan, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Congo, Somalia, Colombia, Sri Lanka, Haiti, to name a few, make clear that war is no passing event. Wherever war unfolds, it shapes those environments where multitudes of beings resistantly pursue living. By understanding war as a structure rather than as a passing event, we're pushed to consider its formative qualities, albeit deadly ones, for living environments, in many ways similar to other living environments that to other lethal environments associated with capitalism, nation states, and empire. However, by paying attention to how people actively resistantly live in war, and this ordinary resistance is often deeply enmeshed with military resistance, we can also find hope, defiant, angry, bitter, but hope nevertheless, and sources of creativity, praxis of life as resistance within extractive, contaminated, or world-annihilating conditions, and not only despite them. So this stance of living in a deadly environment, I consider it agential and resistant. So I'm very dismissive of framing such as resilience, which takes on a more like passive, sort of like cowering stance to those conditions. So at the end of World War II, war was outsourced to the Global South by the powers who won that war. As part of the same history and geography, war has been sidelined as an exotic elsewhere by Northern theorists of war. Capitalism, modernity, the nation state, inequality, migration, the environment. War is always this exotic elsewhere, somewhere that's not here. Since war largely involves life worlds inhabited by distant others, prominent Anthropocene preoccupations routinely neglect the ravages of ongoing war in the present, focusing instead on more familiar, because closer to home, or relevant to life in the heart of empire. Calamities such as fossil fuels, nuclear weapons, plantations, indigenous genocide, and climate change. If war enters theories of the disastrous present at all, it's usually at a savage distance. At most, it's brought home through the experiences of imperial soldiers. So, when you think of infamous wars such as Vietnam, which is this year celebrating or commemorating, let's say, the 50th anniversary of its end, or Afghanistan or Iraq, let's say, often it's the figure of the imperial soldier, right, that looms large in those narratives, and hardly the lives of millions of others that have been decimated and destroyed through these imperial adventures. The living worlds, environments, and ecosystems that are blasted apart, eradicated, and lethally contaminated through the ceaseless invasions, occupations, and heavy weaponry of imperial armies are largely absent from Northern theory. So too are the still actively resistant lives of humans and non-humans waging life in these deadly conditions. So I propose fixing this problem by intentionally, mindfully, defiantly growing theory from Southern experiences of the world. You can call this a decolonizing move, if you must. I prefer to describe it as unsavaging, in homage to my first teacher, Michel Rolf Trio, who called for the destruction of what he called the savage slot in anthropology and in hegemonic Northern theory. If you dare study it as a life world and not as an exotic elsewhere, war has much to offer. From an ethnographic perspective, the experience that is closest to what theories of the Anthropocene describe, which is the relentless, reckless, and methodical destruction of the world by people and projects that should know and disingenuously profess to know better, is also the experience of living in and through war. My book illuminates some of these multi-species collectives that through many cycles and seasons of war have sprouted in the war-torn landscapes of South Lebanon, making life here possible. I call these ecologies resistant, for they have actively taken root in this war-seasoned region, where invasions, bombardments, minefields, and white phosphorus are ordinary challenges facing inhabitants every day, inescapable like the weather. So I seek to show what we can learn about war and about survival on a deadly planet from those who must face the end of the world while pursuing their daily bread. By cultivating tobacco in a seasoned battlefield, or by keeping goats in an explosive landscape, or by tending to spirited and fire-resistant trees. As an example, let's take tobacco. a cash crop that was introduced to South Lebanon during the Ottoman Empire and then taken over by the French colonizers. In 1960, it became a Lebanese state monopoly under the Régie Libanaise de Tabac et Tombac. This hardy plant grows in the arid highlands of the Lebanese borderland. Tobacco is a dryland crop that needs no irrigation and has a brief lifespan in the fields. It's planted in February, transplanted in March and April, and harvested in May, June, July, and August. It requires no storage facilities apart from the village home. It's worked by the many hands of village households, the women and children and the elderly, those who have not left the village to earn a living or to fight. Through their cultivation of tobacco and the income that it brings, steadfast people hold onto home and land. Flexible, fleeting, and hardy, tobacco thrives in adverse conditions such as war and occupation, poverty, marginalization, and neglect. The long-suffering villages of this borderland have always relied on the profit guaranteed by tobacco as a key supplemental income. And although it has a tumultuous history, they call it Nebtil Murra, the bitter crop. Tobacco remains a steady lifeline to those who stubbornly remain in their villages through ever-returning seasons of war and devastation. Tobacco therefore roots life in the war season landscape of South Lebanon. It also does so actually in northern Palestine, because of its similar qualities of hardiness its ability to thrive amidst large families and no infrastructure. So everyone knows that tobacco roots life. The Israelis also know this. So in South Lebanon, tobacco, the bitter crop, is also lionized as Nabtat al-Muqawami, the crop of resistance, by those who plant it and who live from it as a source of life. Underwriting life in poverty and neglect, in war and occupation, tobacco vividly exemplifies a resistant ecology. So this last war, it's the resistant ecologies that have come into the center of the frame of destruction. So the military element is almost the collateral damage. What's really interesting to the war machine is the destruction of those ecologies that underwrite life. So nobody's been allowed to return to their homes to plant their crops, especially the tobacco farmers. In war and survival, the landscape is not a bystander. It's an active participant, a partisan in resistance, and an ally to resistant life. Inhabitants of landscapes plagued by seasonal war and other disasters understand this in practical terms. They find ways to survive and even thrive in deadly conditions that endure, what I'm calling the structure or the environment of war, navigating a landscape that's both the source of life and the place of war. They do this because they have to. There's no easy exit. Resistant ecologies, then, are the life-making practices that grow in such landscapes. They are creative, multi-species responses to systems designed to kill and destroy life. Resistant ecologies are diverse ecological relationships and practices that defy necropolitical realities by centering and underwriting life instead of succumbing to the death prescribed and desired by predatory war machines. Goats are another example of resistant ecologies in South Lebanon. Heartbreaking scenes of starving horses stumbling through the streets of southern villages circulated on social media during this war. Abandoned by their owners in the rush to safety, terrified and disoriented by the constant shelling, larger livestock like horses, cows, mules, and donkeys are tragically vulnerable to any change in the environment or to their structure of care. Likewise, domesticated animals like cats and dogs in borderland villages were starving, and kind humans were literally braving death to feed them. Goats, on the other hand, are known for their abilities to thrive in landscapes of war. They're able to nimbly browse across the hills and valleys of the borderland, defying the explosives in the ground because they're too light to spring them. So mines are designed to kill humans. They're measured at the weight of a human step. So when you have a light four-legged creature, the mine is not triggered. So they defy the explosives in the ground because they're too light to spring them. And this is well known. And although it's not a fail-safe strategy, it has allowed goats and their human companions, who make a living alongside them, to continue to thrive, to israh, in a deadly landscape, and to resistantly reoccupy land that has been made deadly and unusable by US-made and Israeli-planted mines. Because goats are light and nimble, they don't spring mines. They're resistant beings who can proliferate in the explosive-strewn meadows of South Lebanon. The meadows left fallow due to mines grow luscious and nutritious and plentiful to the happy goats who traipse through these explosive landscapes, snatching them back for the living from the realms of death. And it's for this very reason that goats are targeted directly by Israeli drones and mortars this last war. In the summer of 2024, for example, an Israeli attack on a farm in Jezzine killed 300 goats and ruined the livelihood of a livestock farmer. In Ramya, my village, the village that I work in, the family of shepherds lost their entire flock of 1,500 goats this war, and only 30 or so remain. When I went back to the village, the two goat herds were just sitting there in the middle of the meadows, in the middle of the fields, just sitting there. And there was nothing to do because there was nothing to plant. The Israelis were on the hill right next by. And the sisters that I was with, they were postulating as to why they were there. And they said, well, those guys are just kind of, they're used to being outside with their goats, and that's what they're doing now. They're just outside, even though they don't have their goats. So, I mean, it's this kind of the groundlessness of this moment. People don't know really what to do with this sort of level of loss. Anyway, so the goats are being targeted this time. And this pattern, actually, of attacking livestock has a long genealogy, beginning in British and French colonial times. And it's very well documented throughout the Israeli, and also throughout the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And it continues across South Lebanon. The Israeli war machine intentionally targets those resistant ecologies that have defiantly sprung up and taken root in necropolitical worlds. Resistant ecologies that have enabled life to continue in a place that they want to empty of life. Life is the target of a predatory war machine that desires to settle and to occupy an empty land. The landscape of South Lebanon is no stranger to fire. The wildfire season usually begins at the end of the dry season, before the first September rains. But fires have been raging constantly in South Lebanon, intentionally ignited by white phosphorus and flare bombs rained down by Israel on Lebanese villages and woodlands. This is not a new development. Israel has been showering South Lebanon with white phosphorus and napalm for decades, attacking the life source of those who live here with the aim of emptying the land of life. These seasons of human-made fire fold into the natural, the anthropogenic rhythms of the arid Mediterranean Maquis landscape, whose native flora and fauna are both drought-resistant and capable of regenerating after fire. Indeed, the rain-fed landscape depends on seasonal fire, but not on white phosphorus fire. In South Lebanon, the orchards, and in particular the olives, whose fruits are both a source of subsistence and of profit to local farmers, are vulnerable to wildfires. Although olives, which are native to the Mediterranean and thrive in arid landscapes and thus are acclimated to fire, do eventually regenerate after fire, they're not fruitful in the years that it takes for them to recover. This impacts the vulnerable communities who rely on them for subsistence and for and income. And this is why, over years of war, many farmers in South Lebanon have shifted to tobacco and goats as their main sources of agricultural income. In this picture, you see the tobacco planted amongst the olives. In the amazing book by Shuri de Molavi, entitled Environmental Warfare in Gaza, which was just recently published, she describes a similar transformation of the agricultural landscapes in Gaza, where settler colonial violence, that she calls a settler colonial climate, to underline its ecological dimensions, has forced Palestinians to shift from citrus and olive cultivation to low-growing cash crops with a speedy turnover, such as strawberries, broccolis, and pineapples. So they plant crops that are for export, that are cash crops, and that are low-lying, and that are sort of allowed within the sort of the topographical restrictions of asymmetrical settler colonial violence and warfare. So how will the multi-species landscapes of South Lebanon regenerate through fires that are not seasonal but that burn all year? These human-made fires in Lebanon, but also, I mean, if you had noticed recently, there were fires around Jerusalem that were raging unchecked. And those landscapes, ironically, are even more vulnerable to fire than the sort of indigenous flora and fauna of the Lebanese landscape. LA, another settler colonial biome that has been extremely vulnerable to fire. But these human-made fires wherever they rage, burn through and destroy human and more than human worlds. Those fires rage while we're in the green season, at the height of summer, during the life-giving harvest of tobacco in South Lebanon, and across the lush meadows where goats graze peacefully in Israeli-laid minefields. I think of the olives, the laurels, the pines, the oaks, the woodlands of wild pistachio and capers and thorns, the birds, the boars, the foxes, the hyenas, the bees, the medicinal and edible herbs that people forage in the meadows. I think of the war-seasoned southerners, the salt of this earth, living through yet another season of war. How will they live through constant fire? Will these fire-resistant life worlds regenerate after this kind of fire? The fire on the Lebanese side of the border were ignited by white phosphorus that was lobbed by the Israelis at the land to cleanse it of resistant life. Before the ceasefire, the resistance on the Lebanese side countered by igniting fires in the settlements and the orchards across the border in front in occupied Palestine. Everything's burning. And the implications for and the possibilities of resistance and regeneration may be different after a certain threshold of destruction. So here we're also like kind of edging again into this like planetary affair. So looking at those who continue to inhabit those landscapes through and after seasons of conflagration may give us some clues what resistant life on this planet might look like in its latest or its last fiery chapter. So here you see an ancient olive that has been uprooted, has been burnt and uprooted. This is one of many. And you can see here in this picture how big that olive tree is. It's an ancient tree. They call them millennial trees locally. Alfin, they call them, like meaning like they've passed thousands of years. And during this last war, they didn't only burn and cut down; they also uprooted them, and many of them were actually taken away, were stolen, taken to occupied Palestine. I don't know what they're done with. Maybe they're sold. I'm sure they're sold. But there's an active attention, like a really kind of mindful attention to uprooting and beyond destruction. To just kind of attend to the ways in which people will be not allowed to return. When the first ceasefire went into effect on November 27th at 4 a.m., the roads heading south were already jammed with traffic. The minute that they thought they could, everyone rushed back to the rubble of their homes, their fields and trees, their livestock, their lives. But the inhabitants of the frontline villages were turned back. Mariam, who lives in one of the frontline villages, told me, "I was on the road by 4 a.m., we were so many, we couldn't fit into the van that stopped for us. We had him drop us off on the line and to go back for the rest. I finally made it back to my village. I didn't leave for that whole first year of war. I was only forced to leave at the end of September 2024 during the escalation. But when we got to the village, the Israelis immediately started shelling us and we had to leave again. As of this writing, the occupation is ongoing and the future, if there is one, is unknown. When I drove through the villages and towns of South Lebanon in mid-December, this was 2 weeks after the first end of the so-called ceasefire, I beheld a familiar sight. So the first time I visited, 2 weeks after the first end of the ceasefire, I was only able to go to the secondary row of villages because they weren't allowing anybody to get closer to the first row of frontline villages. So this is in the area around Nabatieh, for those of you who know Lebanon. When I drove through the villages and towns of South Lebanon in December, 2 weeks after the end of the so-called ceasefire, I beheld a familiar sight. Rubble, ruin, rebar, shreds of life, a notebook, a teddy bear, a scorched tree. It feels both deeply familiar and astoundingly impossible to comprehend. How is this possible? But this is the end of this is the world, or the end of it. And there is an explanation. On the 27th of February, 3 months after the first ceasefire and a few days after the funeral of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, which about a fourth of the Lebanese population attended, we traveled together to the end of the world. My sisters, me, Ghida and her family, Khawla, Zahra, Nawal, the three sisters in my book, the daughters of Busahel. As we entered the village, me at the wheel, my sister beside me, the three sisters sitting in the back, began to pray, together uttering snatches of verses by way of protection. From bullets, from drones, from anguish and heartbreak. Their home is the first in the village. It's a baskuta, as Zahra put it, as flat as a cookie now, Others describe their accordion or their sliced through houses as cakes. Here in the dust in at our feet is the robe that Busahel would put on his strong shoulders on cold winter nights. The trees, Zahra, the youngest sister, exploded in anger and heartbreak. Who cares about broken cement? But those trees are all uprooted. The white fig, the plum, the almond that my father planted. She spied a young sapling still valiantly upright in the ravaged orchard and rushed to it. She's alive, she cried. Zahra fussed around the sapling's roots, pulling away the weeds and clutter of this war of intentional annihilation, propping her up to ensure her continued existence and thus resistance. There. Later, standing beside me in the middle of endless piles of rubble, extending as far as the eye can see, and there on that hill, the sinister machinations of the occupation digging in, I heard my sister whisper to herself in a voice of bewilderment, "This is apocalypse." That the sister said, "This is the village that was." So this is Rida in the house where the picture of the wedding was at the beginning that I showed you. And she found this this picture of the newlyweds from the wedding, and she held it up. And then I took it and I photographed it in front of the rubble of the house. And that's also the house that I was sitting in front of with the family that I told you to note. In the garden today, we sit in an awkward moment after the end of the world. We sit suspended in a space of limb, a time of ceasefire. After 2 months of hell unleashed, after more than 1 year of occupation by fire and intentional, methodical, mechanical, ecocidal devastation in South Lebanon and genocide in Palestine. Every conversation today in this momentary respite from the incessant devastation of this past year of war, where so much was destroyed and so much lost, addresses this stupefying existential predicament. What is now? And where do we go from here? In the aftermath of the massive blows to the leadership and capabilities of Hezbollah, the military resistance in Lebanon, ordinary people are realizing more than ever that the resistance ongoing is them. Their very lives are resistance. This is not an overblown or ideological formulation, but it's a very prosaic one. It's terrifying, this reality that we're confronting, that we're currently inhabiting. It feels like, because it is, the end of the world. And yet, it's hardly the first end of the world. As we sit together, many voices mingle, discussing life and wars. So today, on the memory of, or the commemoration of, the ongoing Nakba, the 77th year, right? There were many wars in the interim. So as we sit together in the garden, the many voices mingle, and they're discussing their lives and all those wars. And then Khawla asks, "Do you remember in 1967 when the whole village ran and took refuge in Salhani?" It's a nearby ruined village next to their village. She was referring to the seven-day war with Israel when the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula were all invaded and occupied by Israel. Munya says, "Yes, that's where I took my first steps." So these are like the life memories, right, that come out in relation to those many seasons of war. Amidst the laughter, the old Hajji turns to me, her eyes still red with tears, and she puts a warm hand on my arm. "I've been living in war since I was 6, she says matter-of-factly, looking into my eyes. The first war that she means is the Palestinian Nakba. The gathering in the garden that's not the village cannot go back to the village. Their village has been turned to dust. And as one of the completely destroyed frontline villages was still occupied until the end of the ceasefire, which ended on January 27th, the first time, and then again on February 18th. South Lebanon is still under occupation. Sahel, the son of the Hajji, once told me at the close of another war, the end of another world, back in 2006. He said, "My love for this land is not ideological. It is ihsas wa'i, a practiced presence, actual and placed feeling. That's what it means, more or less. This very ordinary but also very powerful praxis is key to resistant life in this region. And it is what the war machine and empire cannot comprehend in their cold and calculated metrics of annihilation, punch drunk on power. So you have Trump saying, who wants to go back to Gaza? It's all destroyed. We'll build you a lovely Riviera, you know, somewhere else where you can go to. And the Palestinians, the inhabitants of Gaza, who also, I mean, who love their homes, but who have also been displaced there, right? Since in the many years of the Nakba and the many waves of the Nakba that have been ongoing, they say, we don't want to go anywhere. We want to go back to Gaza, right? So this is the disconnect between the calculation and the metrics of the war machine and those who are resistantly living within it. So this is what the war machine and empire cannot comprehend in their cold and calculated metrics of annihilation, punch drunk on power. In an asymmetrical battlefield, this matters. Even when all hope appears to be lost, it's not, because life remains. I grew up with this phrase, and I still defiantly believe it, and will continue to repeat it again and again, beyond the end of the world. Ash-shamsu tashriqu min al-janub. وَالشَّمْسُ تَشْرِقُ مِنْ فَلَسْطِينَ. The sun rises from the south, and the sun will rise from Palestine. Thank you.